questions of law. The facts are not particularly in dispute, but we will see about that. That basically it's a question of law. As I understand it, what he and his lawyer Gary Dickey argue is that that Tony Visignano is not eligible to be a candidate in this race because he's not an eligible voter. And the argument that they would make is that just because has a conviction of an aggravated misdemeanor, that's an infamous crime under the Constitution of Iowa, and therefore he's not an eligible voter. Not being an eligible voter, he's not an eligible candidate. But just that's what I gleaned from the document file. We will let Mr. Chido and his attorney proceed and make their argument.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Gary Dickey of Dickey & Campbell Law Firm in Des Moines, appearing on behalf of Mr. Chido. Just a few housekeeping matters. General Miller, I'd like to set out what I understand the record to be. First, we filed an objection, a memorandum of authorities. We also filed an appendix. And then on Monday, we filed a motion for recusal. This morning, I received the response from you, General Miller. Just briefly before this hearing, I received a response from Mr. Bisignano's attorney. Am I missing anything in the record?
I don't think you are.
Okay. I have one additional exhibit, which I've marked as exhibit number 8. It's an affidavit from William Claiborne. And with that, I would move the admission of our exhibits 1 through 8 into the record.
Are there any objections?
No objections.
No objections. They'll be admitted.
General Miller, at this point, we'd like to present some testimony into the record, and we would call Anthony Bisignano.
Proceed.
Mr. Bisignano, would you step forward?
And Tom, do you want to move over to and sit with the team there, or with whatever, wherever you'd like to sit?
Could you begin by providing us your full name?
Anthony Francis Bisignano.
And what's your date of birth?
5/14/52.
Mr. Bisignano, have you received a copy of the objection that I filed on Mr. Chido's behalf?
Yes.
Have you also received the memorandum of authorities that were filed? That was filed, excuse me?
I'm not sure what you refer to.
Well, have you had a chance to thoroughly review the objection that was filed last Thursday?
No.
Okay. Well, then what I want to do is go through and establish your criminal history, unless you will concede that how we've set it out in the objection is accurate.
As I understand, the purpose of this meeting is to determine whether an OWI-2 under the Iowa law has a reason to be disqualified from voting. Beyond that, I have no comment.
Okay.
And you would concede that you have been convicted of an OWI-2?
Of course.
Okay. So, in our objection, we set out your other criminal history, and I'm just asking, do you have any objection to...
General Miller, I'm going to object to this line of questioning. It's beyond the relevancy of this proceeding. He stipulated to the OWI second. That should be all that's necessary.
I would think that's all that's relevant. And like I said at the beginning, I don't think there's a lot of factual dispute here. That it's a pretty clear question of law. He has an OWI-2. It's an aggravated misdemeanor. What are the legal consequences of that?
Mr. Bisignano, what is your current occupation?
Human Resource Director for Polk County.
And how long have you held that position?
9 years.
Does your position include any responsibilities to lobby?
No.
Has it ever included any responsibilities to lobby?
Objection. Again, I'm going to object to relevancy. This is not related to the OWI second issue.
General Miller, from what I understand, Mr. Bisignano had been compensated to lobby in the past. I'm just making sure that there are no conflicts in terms of any lobbying activities that he may have done in the past with any members on this panel. I haven't had a chance to take a deposition. I've had no opportunity for pre-hearing discovery, so I'm exploring the record.
I can tell you I haven't seen Tony in years. So. He has not lobbied me.
First okay. time I've never met Tony, so this is the first for me.
So it's safe to say you haven't lobbied any of the three branches that are represented here?
I've not lobbied.
Okay.
Yeah. With three offices, you gave us quite a compliment there to make the branch.
Three offices. Mr. Bisignano, do you maintain a Facebook account for your Senate campaign?
Yes.
And on March 13th, did you make a posting on that Facebook account asserting that you had spoken to the Attorney General's office some time ago about your eligibility to hold public office?
No. Not that I recall, as I spoke to the Attorney General's office, I received a document from the Attorney General's office.
Okay. So let's back up. Did you make that posting on your Facebook account that you had quote?
I don't recall.
Well, have you personally spoke to somebody in the Attorney General's office about your eligibility to hold public office?
No, I don't recall.
Okay. Who did you receive the memo concerning eligibility for public office? Who did you receive that from?
Carl Wiederender.
In this case, you've signed an affidavit of candidacy in which you declare that you're aware that you would be disqualified from holding public office if you were convicted of an infamous crime. Do you remember that?
Correct.
And to be clear, Governor Branstad has not restored your citizenship rights following your January 14th second offense OWI conviction.
Correct.
And the President of the United States has not restored your citizenship rights.
Correct.
So, Mr. Bisignano, what do you understand the definition of infamous crime to mean?
Objection as to relevancy, the witness's understanding of infamous crime is not the issue here.
Yeah, it's a legal question that we'll need to discuss and debate, and his position on the issue can be stated by his lawyer.
Okay, so
I'm going to ask a follow-up question. Is it your understanding that your citizenship rights were removed at the time of your second OWI?
No.
Okay. So you never thought that you would have had to seek any sort of relief to have citizenship rights restored because you're stating that you're not aware if you ever had those?
I've never heard of anyone losing their citizenship rights as a result of an OWI-2.
Okay. I'm just curious if it's relevant to your question.
So when you signed the affidavit, Mr. Bisignano, is it safe to say it was your opinion at the time that a second offense OWI is not an infamous crime?
No, that's not what I said. I said when I signed the affidavit, I assumed that I qualified to run for office based on information that I'm personally aware of, which no one has ever been disqualified for an OWI-2 that I'm aware of.
Okay. Do you remember signing the affidavit which says...
Absolutely.
Okay. And I guess, and I know it's subject to the objection, but I guess I want it in the record as an offer of proof. Mr. Bisignano, what did you understand an infamous crime to mean at the time you signed that affidavit?
I have no idea what infamous crime by the definition of the law is.
That's all the questions that I have.
Okay. Thank you. You want to proceed further about making legal arguments? How would you like to proceed?
Sure. That's all the testimony or evidence that we have. I don't know if they want to present evidence. I'm prepared to make a legal argument.
Okay. Any evidence that you want to present?
No evidence. Well,
I have.
I'm sorry. Yes.
On behalf.
I'll call Tom Yoakum as a witness.
I think, or believe in talking to how this panel is going to move forward. And in light of what I just heard, in light of what I just heard, maybe a historical perspective as to conversations that were held throughout the course of this would be appropriate now, and I think that's what I'm going to attempt to do. And I had talked to the people who were in charge of putting the panel together, not the Attorney General, no officer, but. So I'll proceed with the statement, if that's okay.
You can proceed.
All right. In early December of 2013, I received a phone call from Tony Bisignano informing me that there was going to be a story in Des Moines publication called City View about how his conviction for second offense OWI would make him ineligible to run for office. I told him that I didn't know enough about the law to say whether or not that was the case, but I did know that if he was declared ineligible to run for office, then he would also not be eligible to vote. He would lose his voting rights. More importantly, I told him I knew of plenty of people, as I'm sure most of the people in this room do, who have two OWI convictions, who are either politically active or at least regular voters. We both expressed concern that if there was any validity to this claim, then it could result in legal action that could potentially strip thousands of Iowans of their voting rights. In my work on behalf of labor unions, I was concerned about how this might impact some of their members. We both decided that I would check into this matter, and we both agreed that if we determined that this claim had any validity, he would end his candidacy rather than risk the franchise of thousands of Iowans who are in the same position he was in legally. I called a friend who worked for one of the unions that had endorsed Mr. Bisignano's candidacy. I explained to her about the potential article in City View and how Tony was willing to step aside if there was a possibility that he could be removed from office. I was told by this person that she had was in the same position, that she had two DUIs and that she had lived in Polk County since 1980, and she was never notified that she was going, that her rights were removed. So that was not a concern. I also expressed a concern that a public discussion of this matter could have a chilling effect on some voters, because in the past there have been attempts to suppress voters in other states where notices have gone out to people that if you were ever arrested or if you have any legal problems, you could be arrested for voting. I then called an attorney who had been acting as an informal advisor to the campaign. He didn't have any legal standing. It was just a question to a lawyer because I'm not an attorney. He informed me that there was an Iowa Supreme Court case and an Iowa Attorney General's opinion that made it clear that a second offense OWI conviction did not disqualify a person from voting or holding office in Iowa. With that knowledge in hand, then and only then did Tony Bisignano decide to continue his campaign. He was comfortable with letting the voters of District 17 decide who they wanted to represent them. To get to the matter that brought us all together, Nathan Blake filed a statement of organization on September 17, 2013, and filed a campaign finance report for the January reporting period. We are aware of the fact that he's knocked on a lot of doors, but also impressed by his fundraising ability. Tony Bisignano filed a statement of organization on June 5th, 2013, and filed a campaign finance report in January. He's garnered endorsements from several organizations that represent people from the 17th district. Ned Chido filed a statement of organization on February 11, 2014, so he didn't need to file a campaign finance report. But the only activity that we are aware of from Mr. Chido's campaign that we've directly been involved in or saw was his obsession with removing Mr. Bisignano from the ballot. Mr. Chido has stated in an interview with KCCI that as a former county auditor and commissioner of elections, he'd been aware of the constitutional provisions that prohibit somebody who has been convicted of an aggravated misdemeanor from holding office for a long time. Quote from Mr. Chido. If memory serves me, Mr. Chido was elected in 1984 and then after 2 years resigned from his position as Polk County auditor.
Tom, you're running a little far afield here. Well, maybe just to summarize it.
Well, to summarize, it's plain and simple. We've vetted this issue. Mr. Bisignano and I had long conversations. We were concerned that if this kind of ruling went against him, if there ever came to this point, that tens of thousands of people would lose their voting rights. It became an issue to us not of Tony's candidacy, but how this was going to impact other people who mind their own business, living their lives, and thinking that they were legal voters. We looked at what happened. The DCI just conducted an investigation, and there are several people who were charged with voting violations because they were ex-felons. It was our opinion and other people's opinions that if they would have gone after people who were convicted of aggravated misdemeanors, there would have been probably more than 10 people who would have been cited and found to have voted illegally. So we've gone through this whole thing clearly knowing that this was not, it should not be an issue, and that what it really was, in fact, was a campaign issue. And it should be debated and worked out by the voters of the 17th district, not by the courts, not by a panel, not by one campaign. That is pretty clear that Tony Vizzignano and the tens of thousands of other Iowans who have been convicted of second offense DUI or other aggravated misdemeanors are not ineligible voters. They should not have their voting rights stripped. They should be able to run for office and be productive citizens. I guess that's the end of it.
Yeah, just, I have some questions.
But,
Mr. Yocum, did you ever speak with an attorney from the Attorney General's office about Mr. Vizzignano's eligibility to?
I've never talked to anybody in their role as an Attorney General. I have had conversations in the course of my business with people from the Attorney General's office, but I've never actually said to anybody, can you give me an opinion as a professional opinion on this?
Okay, so if I understand you correctly, you did talk to somebody who's employed by the Attorney General's office about his eligibility.
Yes, I did.
Okay, who was that person?
The only conversation that I had was, as I recall, was with Kevin McCarthy, and that was just in relationship that Tony was going to get out of the race.
And you didn't have an attorney-client relationship with Mr. McCarthy at the time, did you?
I had a friend relationship with him.
Right, so he's not providing you private legal advice.
He wasn't providing me any legal advice.
Okay, and did you ask Mr. McCarthy, what advice did he provide to you?
He didn't provide me any advice.
Okay. What Supreme Court case did he provide to you?
He didn't provide me with any Supreme Court case.
So when you're talking about the attorney that you spoke with who provided you with an Iowa Supreme Court case,
I actually dug that up myself.
Okay. So to be clear, Mr. McCarthy didn't provide you with the Iowa Supreme Court case.
No, I never received an email or any other communication from Mr. McCarthy.
Okay. So tell me everything about your conversation with him concerning Mr. Vizzignano's eligibility.
My conversation was basically, we understand that there's going to be a story in City View that is going to say that Mr. Vizzignano is ineligible. I was told that you better look closer because I don't think that's the case, that there is an attorney general's opinion and a court case. I've never had that in my possession.
Okay, so did he give you the opinion that there was no merit to any challenge to Mr. Vizzignano's eligibility?
Not really. I talked to other lawyers.
Okay. And I guess I'm not clear. Did he or did he not reference a Supreme Court case during your conversation?
He said there was an attorney general's opinion. And I believe that there was a court case, but that's as far as it went.
Okay. But he didn't give you the name of that court case?
No.
Okay. All right. That's all the questions I have.
Anybody on the panel have questions for Tom Yocum? If not, let's move along then. I think what you envision here would be for Mr. Dickey to make some legal arguments and take some questions from us, and then you will make some legal arguments, questions from us. Then we'll give you each one last chance to make arguments, and then we'll stop.
Sure. Thank you. Let's start with what's undisputed. It's undisputed that Article 2, Section 5 of the Iowa Constitution disqualifies individuals from holding public office if they've been convicted of an infamous crime. That's undisputed. It's also undisputed that an infamous crime is something different than a felony. And we know that because if you read the Iowa Constitution, there are at least three other sections that use the term felony. So We can surmise that infamous crime is something different. Otherwise, the framers of our Constitution would have said anybody who's convicted of a felony would be disqualified from the privileges of an elector. We know that the Iowa Supreme Court, in at least three separate opinions, has defined an infamous crime as any offense for which the maximum penalty is confinement in the state penitentiary. That's undisputed. It's also undisputed that second offense OWI is an aggravated misdemeanor. It's right in the statute, and that an aggravated misdemeanor is punishable by a term of imprisonment of up to 2 years. That's all undisputed. The Iowa Code provides that anybody who's sentenced to more than 1 year in jail is turned over to the custody of the Iowa Department of Corrections. That's undisputed. If you put that together, then an aggravated misdemeanor is an infamous crime. And that's not a conclusion that I reach alone. General Miller, your office on two occasions has reached that opinion in formal published attorney general opinions. Now, I'm also not speaking in abstracts here, theoretical possibilities, as the exhibits that we provided demonstrate the Iowa Department of Corrections today has 16 offenders in prison for second offense OWI. So this isn't some theoretical, philosophical discussion.
16 out of how many that have been convicted?
I know since 2010 to, or excuse me, 2011 to 2014, and that's in the email, I think there's 3,700 individuals that have been convicted of second offense OWI.
Yeah, so it would be half of 1%?
Well, I don't think I mean, we know 16 currently. I don't know how many have served time in prison over that same time period.
Probably less than 1%.
I don't want to speculate. But I mean, the fair point is the suggestion that you actually have to go to prison to be an infamous crime has been rejected by your, I guess it would have been a predecessor to you back in the 1939 opinion. The question of an infamous crime.
But we can agree that it's extremely rare that this does happen.
I would agree with you, just as I would agree with you that it's extremely rare for first time felons of, you know, Class B felons to go to prison. I mean, most of those are eligible for deferred judgments. Most of those go straight to probation. So, you know, I would say,
not to delay the point, their chances are much greater than 1 in 100 or 1 in 200.
I don't want to speculate.
Okay.
I don't agree with that. I mean, so what the Department of Corrections did is they took a look at the OWIs that are standalone OWIs that are not coupled with other offenses, because if you run them together, it affects the outcome. So if you look at only those individuals convicted of second offense OWI, that's where their statistics come from. If you wanted a true apples-to-apples comparison, you'd have to look at Class D and even some Class C felonies that are only those offenses and to do a comparison. And on my anecdotal experience as a criminal defense practitioner, deferred judgments and suspended sentences or probation on Class C felonies are more common than you would think. You know, at this, all of that is undisputed. Okay, so we are not advocating a change in the law. We're actually advocating that this panel follow the law as it currently exists. I mean, Mr. Secretary, if you go to your website, it includes the oath of office that every individual who holds public office must sign. And as part of that oath, it's to defend the Constitution of the United States and the Iowa Constitution. And if you follow the Constitution in this case, it leaves you but only one result, and that is that a second offense OWI is an infamous crime. Now, the impact on voting...
But just back up. You mentioned current law. Isn't current statutory law pretty clear that it's... that disqualifications for felonies, state and federal, and not the rules?
No, I disagree. I disagree with that. That would be inconsistent with, number one, your office's opinion. But
the law has been changed since our opinion. The changes in the 90s and more recently that seem to make very clear, at least as the legislature is concerned, it's only felons that would be disqualified. Now, that may be unconstitutional.
Yeah, right.
You can make the argument it's unconstitutional.
Yeah.
But the current law is pretty clear to us anyway, that it's just felons.
No, I mean, I disagree with that.
You disagree with that?
Yeah.
I mean, if I ask a follow-up for this, on Iowa Code Section 39.3 under definitions, it defines infamous crime. I'm just wondering if how you respond to this. In subsection 8, infamous crime means a felony is defined in Section 701.7 or an offense classified as a felony under federal law.
Right.
Do you think that somehow makes it, there's a difference between what you're arguing and a felony?
I would say
how they define that?
Yeah, I'd say two things to that. First is, that doesn't define infamous crime as it existed in the Constitution. I mean, the separation of powers, the legislature can't, retrospectively change the definition of the constitutional provision. So,
well, in the Constitution, it doesn't say aggravated misdemeanor. It says infamous crime.
Right.
The Constitution doesn't define what infamous crime is specifically.
Right.
And so I think the legislature has the authority to weigh in and try and define for Iowa law what that is. And in 1994, they changed the law and actually defined infamous crime this way. And so my next question was, the three Supreme Court cases and other authorities you cite were prior to 1994, weren't they?
Right.
Okay. So since then, the legislature weighed in.
Yeah, but again, separation of powers, the legislature can't overrule.
No, we understand it. But
yeah,
I'm not arguing.
Right, yeah. So what I would say is, there's a common law understanding of infamous crime, which has been defined three times by the Iowa Supreme Court. And that is a constitutional holding, which cannot be changed through legislation. So, setting aside 39.3, right, this panel and the judiciary will be bound by those prior precedents.
But just so we understand the framework, at least as I understand it, current statutory law is quite clear that it's just felony, state and federal. Matt just read that to you, but let me follow through. That state law is very clear. Now the question becomes whether that's constitutional or not. Or do you argue that current state law is aggravated misdemeanor?
Mr. Visigano is disqualified under two independent grounds, both of which make him ineligible. So the first is directly Article 2, Section 5, in and of itself, regardless of what the legislature has said in statute, in and of itself is a bar, as that infamous crimes clause has been interpreted by the Iowa Supreme Court. So if the legislature passed...
I understand that argument.
So
and you have that argument,
yeah.
And we'll deal with that.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to at least clarify, because I think it has some importance, it's not the final word of anything, but current statutory law is felony, state, and federal.
Yeah, so let me tell you how you read that. Okay, together. It's not a federal conviction that's a felony. It's an offense that's classified as a felony under federal law. Big difference. Because that includes out-of-state convictions. Right? So if somebody's convicted of a crime in Illinois, we don't look to the Illinois law. We look to federal law as to whether or not that would be classified as a felony. Because otherwise, if we go down that road, General Miller, if Mr. Bisignano was convicted of a felony in Illinois, Iowa statute would be wholly silent on it. Okay, so that interpretation is inconsistent. I mean, it's not one that can be manageable. The more reasonable interpretation is any offense, regardless of its federal or state, that is classified as a felony under federal law, because that's what the statute says. If that's true, then you look at federal law, which we've cited here in the United States Sentencing Guidelines, make clear, and the Eighth Circuit has decided that second offense OWI is a felony under the United States Sentencing Guidelines. So,
well, can I ask you a question about that? So if I commit a federal felony and I am convicted and the judge goes to sentencing, when I go to the sentencing guidelines, those guidelines require me as a judge to take those things into consideration. There's no federal law that says OWI in the second degree is a federal offense. It's saying as a judge, because this person being convicted of a federal crime on something else, I'm going to take all this other stuff into consideration, and it's stating when I take that into consideration, this is one of the things I can take into consideration. It's not saying it's a federal OWI second is a federal offense, correct?
Correct. Yeah, so the general definition of felony under a federal statute is anything punishable by more than a year in prison. So, you know, Iowa's got this weird quirk in its law for aggravated misdemeanors where every other state in the federal system would consider that a felony for reasons that occurred 30 years ago, almost 40 years ago. Now, what the sentencing guidelines say, that if you're convicted of any offense in the federal system, when you go to determine your criminal history for purposes of deciding what the sentence should be, if you're convicted of a felony offense, then it elevates your sentence. And it's defined in the sentencing guidelines, and felony offense is anything for which there's punishment more than a year. And using that, the Eighth Circuit has said specifically, second offense OWI is a felony under the United States sentencing guidelines. It's not a federal offense,
correct,
but it's classified as a felony offense under federal law, which is precisely the language that's used in 39.3.
But what you're saying is that under current law, your argument would be current statutory law, constitutional argument, set aside, that Mr. Bisignano would run afoul of it, not because it's an aggravated misdemeanor, but because of the federal sentencing guidelines.
Well, sort of both. I mean, I guess the only way to harmonize 39.3 is you take a look at the offense, and regardless of how Iowa defines it, felony, aggravated, how is it defined in federal law? And federal law would define it as a felony because the punishment exceeds 1 year in prison. And so under the sentencing guidelines, that's a felony offense.
A U.S. attorney is not going to prosecute you for getting your second drunk driving, correct?
Unless it occurred on a an Indian reservation or on a federal
But in this case, in Mr. Bisignano's case, the U.S. attorney is not going to prosecute him. The fact that they don't have the ability to prosecute him, correct.
Now, I want to make clear, Mr. Secretary, that it's not just federal offenses that are covered by 39.3, because that's what they want you to read, and they want to mismatch the way it's an offense classified under federal law as a felony. Because if you read it the way that you're suggesting and that they're suggesting, then
I don't know what they're suggesting.
Well, I mean, in their brief, they suggested it.
Yeah. Okay.
But if that's the case, then people, in Minnesota and Illinois and Missouri who have as many felony convictions as possible can move to Iowa, and 39.3 doesn't apply. And clearly, there would be no statute that would bar a felon from out of state coming in if you're saying 39.3 applies in that way. And clearly that's not what the legislature intended. So, based on the record that we have here, they offer no factual defense to the record that we presented that individuals who are convicted of second offense are going to prison. Mr. Claiborne's affidavit, which we provided you today, clearly sets forth he was at the Iowa Medical Classification Center for 30 days. And that's a prison. That's not a jail. He was issued a parole, which is important because if you go to the parole board statute, they can only parole somebody who's in the custody of the Iowa Department of Corrections. So, somebody who's in jail is not eligible for parole. Somebody who's on probation is not eligible for parole. If they go straight to probation, they bypass the Iowa Department of Corrections and go to the Department of Correctional Services. So, this has. We're not asking you to change the law, and I am sympathetic. I'm as sympathetic as anybody there in this room, based on my personal experience. I'm as sympathetic as anybody. I helped craft it. Governor Vilsack is the one who issued it. But I'm as sympathetic as anybody because since 2005 and before, the governor's office under Governor Vilsack took the position based on the attorney general's opinion that aggravated misdemeanors result in the loss of the right to vote, which is precisely why we included that provision in Executive Order Number 42. So I get that there may be tens of thousands of people. A vast majority of them received a blanket restoration in 2012. And subsequently going forward on a monthly basis all the way until Governor Branstad took office and changed it. There is a remedy for Mr. Bisignano, and that is for him to apply to have his citizenship restored. And it's unlikely that that would occur in time for him to run for office.
Can he apply to Governor Bill's act?
No, he can't apply. He could apply to President Obama, but...
And then Governor Branstad.
Yeah, no, and look, so here's why I'm sympathetic. If our policy had continued, Mr. He's still on probation, but eventually he would automatically get it back. So the purpose of this is not to disenfranchise people. That decision was made back in 1857 when the Iowa framers got together and decided that.
In 1857, there was no such thing as drunk driving. Maybe drunk riding, but there was no drunk driving in 1857. And so to think that the founders of our Constitution had thought of this as being an infamous crime wasn't the case back then. Correct.
Well, they did not have 321.J in mind, right, because it didn't exist. But here's what they did have in mind, that those individuals who are subject to infamous punishments, because that was a state of law back then, those individuals who are confined to a penitentiary, not a jail, have an infamous punishment, and they made a value judgment that those individuals are not worthy of holding public office. Okay, so that's the value judgment they made back then, and we are not in a position to change that without an amendment going through the amendment process. So
are you arguing that Mr. Bisignano spent time in the penitentiary?
No, and that's really irrelevant. That's irrelevant.
I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, I'm not suggesting that. I mean, he spent time in jail, not in a penitentiary. But that's irrelevant because it's the maximum potential, because it's impractical to be able to sort through all the thousands of individuals and see who actually went to prison and who didn't. That's unmanageable. But I mean, to the extent that it relates to voting rights, there is a mismatch between the code and what the Constitution says. And it's a mismatch I've recognized since my time in the governor's office. That is, the process for an auditor to take individuals off the voting rolls is not consistent with the state of law in terms of voting eligibility. And the legislature hasn't caught up with that mismatch. And we're not asking. In a perfect world, you could do a couple of things. You could change the penalty for OWI so that it's a serious misdemeanor with a higher mandatory minimum. You could change the aggravated misdemeanor structure because Iowa is an outlier in terms of defining a two-year sentence as anything other than a felony. Or you could change the voting process where you're culling individuals off of the voting roll who are convicted of an aggravated misdemeanor. I mean, either of those alternatives would align the Iowa Code with the policies and the provisions of the Iowa Constitution. We're not making a suggestion we need to do any of that, because the only issue before this panel is whether or not Mr. Bisignano has been convicted of an infamous crime, and that's clear. I mean, in their brief, they don't offer an alternative explanation for infamous crime other than it only applies to felonies, which we know isn't the case because the framers used two separate phrases in our Constitution. So we ask that you sustain the objection and that you deny Mr. Bisignano the opportunity to run for Iowa Senate District 17.
Let me have you comment on this sort of scenario or description of what has happened over 100 years. The court approximately 100 years ago decides that there's any jeopardy of spending time in the penitentiary with hard labor, that it's an infamous crime. And basically that's felonies at that time. So then back in the 70s, and I think it was in the criminal code revision, they came up with this, as you described it, outlier, anomaly provision, that people could spend 2 years in prison. And therefore were subject to prison, consistent with the opinion. But it's an outlier, it's a misdemeanor. But they make that decision. And then the legislature comes along in the 90s and makes a provision that it's felonies. And so, you know, assume for the sake of sort of argument and discussion, we don't accept your argument on the sentencing guidelines as a way to bring that in. So the legislature does a fairly comprehensive rewrite of the law that's directed just at felonies. The practice has been to allow people who have aggravated misdemeanors to vote and to run for office. Our calculations of how many people are in jeopardy is about 50,000. If you look at the aggravated misdemeanors since Governor Branstad became governor, it's about 50,000. 50,000 people would like to vote would be at place in this election. Could you see the Supreme Court, you know, think at least what the legislature has done is relevant, it's not controlling, and then go back, you know, with the changed conditions that we've experienced. And this court, all courts are protective of 50,000 people's right to vote. Say that the Iowa legislation, in light of today, in light of that anomaly that took place in the 70s, is correct, and we're not going to disenfranchise 50,000 people.
I've got several points in response. First of all, I disagree with your calculation on the number of 50,000 individuals, right? So there may be 50,000 aggravated misdemeanor convictions, but you have to really drill down for a couple of things. One is, how many of those aggravated misdemeanor offenders also have a felony that's riding along? Because that would be independently. Nobody disputes that a felony is an infamous crime. Two, you'd have to drill down and see how many of those aggravated misdemeanors resulted in a deferred judgment, because a deferred judgment is not a conviction under Iowa law, except when the Supreme Court says that it is. But our office treated, when I say our office, Governor Vilsack's understanding was that a deferred judgment is not a conviction and doesn't result in. So I think it's substantially less of the actual people who would be affected. Now,
okay, so 35,000.
Well, I wouldn't even go that high. But assuming it's 35,000, what you're asking then is, well, shouldn't we just make a policy judgment that those individuals should vote? And you know what? I agree with that policy judgment. I mean, but you're not a policy-making board.
You may have misunderstood. We are bound by the Constitution. We're bound by the statute. And, you know, we look at the statute, we see that clearly there's constitutional arguments to be made. But in light of what I've said, that it's an anomaly, things have changed, we could see the court upholding the statute. We assume by law, by decision, that the statutes are constitutional. They have that presumption. So we take that presumption, we take the likelihood of the Supreme Court to reverse that 100-year-old decision because things have changed in between. It's not our policy decision. It's really the policy decision of the legislature that we think is supporting.
Well, my response would be that is clearly that would be a clearly unconstitutional infringement by the legislature. So, for example, the Constitution sets out the eligibility of individuals both to vote and to run for public office. So there's an age limit for governor. I think it's 30 or 35. The legislature couldn't come in and pass a law tomorrow and say that if you're 25, you can run for governor. Right, because that's in direct conflict with the Constitution. So if the infamous crime provision is what the Supreme Court says it is, then the legislature can't 20, 50 years later come back and say, no, we're going to legislatively change the definition of infamous crime.
But so, could so, they, you know, could they, with the constitutional decision in question, with it being fragile, can the legislature sort of anticipate in good faith enacting legislation that might produce a reversal in the decision?
Well, I mean, I guess I take issue with the suggestion that it's a fragile decision. I mean, it's been affirmed. It started out nearly 100 years ago, and it's been affirmed twice since.
In the 50s with no analysis whatsoever.
Well, no analysis.
And before this anomaly has taken place concerning aggravated misdemeanor.
Okay, so then let me ask you this, Joan Miller, and if you want to answer it, then what's the definition of infamous crime? I mean, the legislature clearly does not have the authority to change the constitutional definition. No, they're not even asserting that.
It will be what the Supreme Court says. I mean, we're anticipating something.
It's not like the legislature that the Constitution said OWI second is you can't vote, you can't hold office if you commit this crime. It's not like the legislature then wrote, oh no, it is. They didn't do that. And it's not specific. The Constitution is not specific as to what is defined as an infamous crime. And so the legislature comes in 100 years later, more than that, and says, this is how we define, for purposes of Iowa code, what an infamous crime is, and that is a felony. You're stating that your opinion is the legislature can't do that.
Right. And I mean, I think there's clear case law on that. If qualifications to vote and hold public office are constitutionally based, the legislature can't come in and say otherwise. That's unconstitutional. Now, your point is this. I get your point that they didn't say second offense OWI in the Constitution, but they didn't say murder. They didn't say robbery. So if the legislature...
They're pretty vague, actually.
Right.
So the legislature, in that sense, when the Constitution is vague, doesn't the legislature have a duty then to outline what those things mean?
No. I mean, No, under our system of separation of powers, the judiciary interprets what the Constitution means. I mean, if the legislature wants to pass additional policy within the confines of the limitations set out by the Constitution, that's their prerogative. They do not get to interpret definitions of constitutional freedom. They certainly don't get to change.
If the legislature disagrees, they can pass a law and then it can go up to the courts, and the courts can then say the legislature is wrong. Right,
which is
what hasn't happened.
No, because nobody's challenged it. But the legislature, look, what's the definition of speech, right? The framers didn't tell us what the definition of speech is. But if legislature tomorrow says we define speech as only, you know, written publications, everything else can be regulated, without a doubt that would be unconstitutional.
Well, it would be when it goes up to the court and the court says it's unconstitutional.
Well, right. And that's in your job in this case. Is a quasi-judicial, if not a judicial, body. You're not asked to make value judgments and set out what the policy should be for voters or for people holding office. You're to apply the facts as it's been, as the law requires. Right.
And right now the law says an infamous crime is defined as a felony. So it would be rational for us, the body, to say, well, the statute says this, we're going to follow the statute, and if the parties disagree, you still have due process, and you'll be able to appeal to a higher authority, because clearly we are not the highest authority on this issue, correct? I mean, there's still a rational basis in the law that the legislature passed to look at this and say, well, infamous crime is defined as a felony.
Yeah, and that's your prerogative. But to get to that conclusion, you have to ignore Article 2, Section 5. And if that's what the ultimate outcome of this panel is, I would ask that in the record that you set forth, hey, we think this statute, the legislative change in 1994 retroactively changes, you know, nearly a century of understanding of what infamous crime and punishment is. Because that will make the appeal easier for us.
It's unlikely we can make you.
The three cases by the Supreme Court that says an infamous crime is anything punishable by time in prison, that they don't offer anything. Their only argument is the second offense, OWI, shouldn't result in going to prison. They don't even argue that the Supreme Court was wrong. And if you really drill down in those Supreme Court opinions, they did a really good job in the earliest one, I think it's a 1917 case, going back to 1857 and looking at a judicial opinion from Massachusetts, which is contemporary with when the framers of the Constitution were passing this provision, and it says an infamous punishment is somebody who goes to prison, and if that's not infamous, then what is?
Yeah, I guess, you know, my focus, rightly or wrongly, is on the 35,000. That currently are that wouldn't be able to vote. I think that's obviously a very serious matter. I think the ordinance would do that as very serious. There's also a question of sort of disrupting in part the primary election by having to take steps to take those 35,000 to 50,000 people off the rolls. Those 35,000 to 50,000 are very important. And the court would think they're very important and would act accordingly. And they are central to the enormous change in conditions between the 100-year-old decision and today, the anomaly that you talked about, that would form the basis for the Supreme Court to rethink and redo something that was done 100 years ago under very, very different circumstances. So that's my concern, and that's where I think the court would be concerned, and I think that's the sort of nexus to move from the one decision to a different result.
So what I would point out to you, General Miller, is I read the statute. There is no ability to call those individuals who have been convicted of an aggravated misdemeanor off the rolls. I mean, that's part of the disconnect. As I read it, it's the auditor's responsibility to get the felon list.
No.
Okay.
The judicial branch is responsible to give us the felon list.
Okay, right. So what about the felons in Illinois, in Missouri, who have, you know, moved over here? That's not on that list. I mean,
well, I guess it'd be a bigger challenge so you could, you know, construct that list and keep people from voting and
right. There's no proactive way of getting a perfect list, but there is a, you know,
But the big reason, you know, is the ability of those.
But I think the opinion from your office in 1985 is spot on. Right? Maybe the Iowa Supreme Court would view that definition differently, but until they say otherwise, you're bound by it. And that's what we would suggest to this panel.
I understand. But what is different from that time is the legislation and our responsibility to enforce legislation, even if it has some questions concerning constitutionality.
Even if we set all that aside, under the legislation, this is a felony offense under federal law.
We'll deal with that argument. But if we resolve that argument against it, then this discussion comes into play. Mary, is there anything you want to ask?
A couple of questions. We have not removed second-degree DUIs from voter lists, correct?
I don't know.
I think that is correct.
People involved in elections have been following the law and possibly in opposition to the Constitution. So I just wanted to make sure that was understood by everybody, because that's no small detail in this proceeding. And one of your statements in this document, and I'm in the memo of authority, while federal offense on the rise is not a federal crime, it's classified as a felony in the federal sentencing guidelines. And I'm not sure what the difference is. I'm not a lawyer, but what the difference between the sentencing guidelines and the law?
Sure. So there is a federal criminal code that's essentially, it's like the Iowa criminal code. So there are wire fraud, for example, is a federal offense. Okay, so there is no OWI offense in federal law unless it occurs on Indian reservation, or Native American reservation, or a federal land. Okay, but there is a whole body of federal sentencing guidelines, right? Which is law. And under that, under the definitions in that federal sentencing guidelines, in order to enhance somebody's sentence, because they do a very mechanical way of sentencing, if you have a felony, you have a higher sentence because you have a higher criminal history. So under the definition of felony under the United States sentencing guidelines, the federal sentencing guidelines, it includes anything over a year and a day is a felony. And
right.
So the Eighth Circuit, there was a challenge by an individual from Iowa who had a second offense OWI, and their sentence was elevated because of that, and the district court said that's a felony under federal law. They took it up to the Eighth Circuit, and his argument was, no, that's an aggravated misdemeanor. And the Eighth Circuit said, no, under federal law, it's classified as a felony under the sentencing guidelines.
Because of the guidelines, because it was more than a year.
Right, exactly.
So if it's a deferred judgment, is less than a felony?
A deferred judgment's not a conviction. So under Iowa law, you need both a finding of guilt and an actual imposition of sentencing to have a conviction.
I guess I'm just thinking the sentencing guidelines are variable depending on the crime.
Right.
So that's not crystal clear to me, given each and every circumstance. So it would be variable in each circumstance. It's just a guideline, depending on the offense.
Yeah, all of these are, yeah, I mean, all of the offenses depend upon the penalty. I mean, what I suspect the federal government was saying is we're not going to treat criminal history based on the variability of how states treat it. So you can have a 5-year punishment, you can call it a misdemeanor, but we're not going to be bound by that. We're going to classify that as a felony for federal sentencing purposes, which is why you have that federal law. I mean, that the federal sentencing definition of itself.